Philosophers in
space, 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 space.
Weapon selection is critical. If I see one more idiot attacking a Jedi with a blaster pistol, then I'll kill them myself.
All these questions? Is a little blind faith too much to ask?
If you want a picture of the future, imagine a clown's shoe stamping on a human face forever.
I've never felt like a she or her, so I would prefer they or them.
Hello and welcome to Philosophers in Space, listener Q's 20. Wow, I'm happy
Big
to be
2-0.
Here. I'm Thomas, that's Aaron. How you doing?
I'm pretty excited. I feel like listener Q's 19 was one of our strongest, maybe the strongest listener Q we've had so far. Mm. So I'm looking forward to some regression to the mean in this particular episode. I just want to get everyone's expectations back.
I've been
down
regressing
to a reasonable
level. The mean for a long time. I don't know when I'm going to hit that mean.
We'll find it. We'll get there.
Yeah, I think the listener Q's is I never know what to expect. I never know what's what curveballs are going to be thrown at us.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep, it's pretty wild. I like it.
All right. Well, should we get going?
We should.
Should we name names, Aaron?
Let's name some names, right?
It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing.
I believe I have a little list here. Let's see. Here, thanks to Chad T, Michael Sullivan, Ali Akta Est, Dahak, No Commute So Behind on Podcasts, David W. Whitecar, Mads Ripe, Matthew Laird,
Vizalin the Cobalt Monk. It's David M. Yeah. Whitecar, and the only reason I pointed out is it's kind of funny because my kids do the same thing. Like, it's weird. M's and W's, like, they don't get that it's upside down or not for a while, you know? Anyway. Maybe another couple years, buddy. You'll learn. No, I'm just kidding.
I'll get there. It's a lot harder than Martian, is what I'm saying. Jesse Urbanowitz and Brenda Goodman, Brian Studwell, Adam Ronhove, anti-nunciation is apparently a thing.
That's good.
That's brutal. I am a vegan heathen, Scott the Woodworker, just call me Zachary. Carol, and this one is not my fault. It looks like Strinitsky, but there's some weird symbols in there. Lone Locust, Liam Skoda, Electrical Tentacled Chastity Asteroid Belter. A little bit of X-Pants there. John Bartlett, Byron G, Dylan Lark, Brycey Poo, and I Want to Be the Tempeh in Your Foucault and Camus Sandwich. Ooh, strong start.
That was fun. That talk about regression in the mean right there. That was back to
right. We're back to the classics.
But I love you are anti-enunciation. That's your new political affiliation. all right. 1 trillion mildly gruntled clams asks, on estimating hypothetical future util vessels, should utilitarianism advocate making us a trillion mildly gruntled clams? Okay, referencing their name there. What do you make of this as a principle? Act to avoid constraining the future if you can. Act to remove constraint from the future. From Graydon Saunders in the Commonweal series.
Yeah, so this is a cool question. It's reminiscent of something that I saw, I think we talked about a little bit recently in the kind of AI ethics programming world, having to do with how do you teach an AI to not solve its problems by like turning the whole universe into paperclips, right? Yeah. And one method that some folks are attempting is to give the AI a sense of the sort of state of the universe and the possible options that the various states of the universe allow for it, so that it can then like leave the world in such a way where more options are available rather than less. And so the idea that would create a kind of indirect domesticity for the AI, because things that would generally involve more options would be things like not turning the whole world into paper clips. So an example of this that they used was, everybody's probably played some version of a game where it's a puzzle game and you've got a little person who can push blocks around and you have to push them into the right order to escape, and certain blocks can get locked into positions and they can't be moved again, right? You're stuck. So you
we've all
think
played
ahead.
Tetris.
No. Yeah. But the cool thing is, it's
little man
they taught
there.
The AI, right?
just jumping around. That's that game, right?
I think you're thinking of Dr. Mario, but that's fine.
No, that's where you try to overdose of something. Yeah.
Right.
That's where you try to commit medical malpractice as fast as possible.
Yes. So the idea was they taught the AI to win the game with the most number of open moves still available for it, so that like it left the world in such a state where if it like had to, it could move things around a bunch more still. So I think that's to me one sort of cool example of this like act to avoid constraining the future. What would that actually look like?
I can't wait for the obvious like bad side effect of that. I think that's a really interesting idea, and maybe that is a better heuristic than some others, you know, that we could think of. But like, I can't wait for there to be some weird consequence to this. Like,
right,
the AI takes over and it's like, open every door, and like we can't have doors closed, you know, like it's like no more privacy or something. Like,
yep, it turns the entire universe into like an ambiguous, homogenous goo, because that goo could potentially instantiate more possibilities
turns
than any finite substance.
Each of us into like Swiss Army knives, like so we have different little functions that we can do.
That's right.
Just like the idea that like you're in like, you know, I don't know, the frozen tundra in Russia, and it's like, nope, door's open, sorry. Yeah, it's freezing out there, you know, like it just, I can't, the possibilities, we need maximum possibilities.
It could replace us with computers that can have two more bits than our brains can possibly have, and thereby increase the number of like potential computations that can be done. There are ways in which, so it's the sort of thing where you would want that to be a limiting factor, but not its prime motivation, essentially, right? It's sort of like it's a constraint in that sense. The other side of this, the if you can act to remove constraint from the future, that one's like a very kind of, it also feels, it could be, go very open-ended in the sense of like what an individual defines as a constraint is going to vary a lot from individual to individual, and like what kind of constraints are we talking about wanting to try to remove here.
I'm just trying to think of other things this is going to do. I think it's like if someone goes too slow on the freeway, you know, then it's all of a sudden the Skynet satellites just blows up the car. Everybody may freely move now.
I would assume you'd use a passive model, so it would just scatter the car onto a road that would have slower speed limits.
Well, that's interesting, though. Interesting to think about. I like that. I also, every time I think about this, I'm like, maybe just don't do AI, actually. Just don't. Just avoid the whole thing. Sounds hard to do correctly.
Yeah, and just a note, this wasn't originally an AI question. I took it in that AI direction, you could mention, for example, so I think the classic ethics version of what I would be putting forward here would be, what is considered to be bad about the trillion mildly gruntled clams scenario is they're never going to make art, right? They're never going to make fun things for us to talk about on Philosophers in Space. There's never going to be a clam show that's going to have a depth of philosophy that we would even spend a whole episode covering that clam show. And so that might seem like it is unfortunate. It leaves out sort of what kinds of freedoms and flourishings could exist in the world. And so that could be sort of another way to broadly think about the avoiding constraining the future. I think I mentioned this before in the culture series, the culture has an objection to what do they call them? Hegemonic swarms. So like entities like gray goos that try to turn everything into one substance, and they think it's very boring, right? It makes the universe much less interesting if everything were, you know, computronium or something like that. So that's another way I think that you could get at the intuition of like a universe of possibilities being more valuable than one that is, strictly speaking, producing more utilities?
Yeah, as far as the clams go, I mean, is there any sort of principle in metaethics of like, well, if you are the one doing, like, if we're the species that's doing the moral calculation, like, do we get any credit for that? Do we get to, like, say, okay, well, we get to have any sort of priority in that, you know?
Right.
We're the ones who are doing this hard ethics work. We at least get to be like, don't turn us into clams. You know, I feel like that's, I don't know, is that ever a principle? Like, no. we get to kind of keep ourselves higher on the pecking order?
I mean, usually it's just done via like naked speciesism or something like that. But I think your idea is funnier to me. It's more interesting because it's sort of like, well, look, we're doing the math.
Yeah.
You know, we should get like a 10%, you know, math tax or something like that. Right. Just like 10% off the top for the humans.
I mean, that's not exactly what I meant, but that is really funny.
It's pretty much where that would end up, I feel like.
I got a couple of utils in my pocket I could sprinkle into your, you know, particular calculation. You know,
just enough to wet my beak is all. Is all,
yeah, you know? Off the books. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, let's bring our next question. I firmly believe you should read all the names, but I guess we agreed that I would read some of them. So, okay.
I can read more. It's fine.
No. Team Later Cheese and Scotch. Neil Upadhyaya, anonymous ethicist, not a serial killer at all, just asking questions. That one gets me every time. Fast as Flash, Justin Haynes, Brian, host of GBRBB and TFIL, Josh Hoku, I'm doing okay these days, trying to spread that love as much as I can. Oh, Mr. Nobody, Ray Ray, Aaron Ashaman, Teresa Gomez, Teresa Gomez, one of my faves of all time. Samuel Leet, Robbie Boparai, Blue Diamond loves GameStop. That sense that you've definitely forgotten something important. Peter in Korea, Blake Beckman, Dancing Sifaka, Naomi Alderman, definitely not a patron, dressed as Aaron, dressed as a patron. Solomon Rigney, James Pittman, Maxwell Skipworth, and Jared. They bring you this question from Hypatia. Under what conditions would you consider engaging in a violent or potentially violent revolution? It doesn't seem to take much for some of us, but is there any point where you could see yourself raiding the Capitol? Huh, what a question. I mean,
and I feel like we get this question frequently in some form or another.
Pretty relevant recently. These days, though.
Yeah. It seems like it's been a current issue on people's minds quite a bit. I'm not quite sure why, but I do think that is an interesting point. Not to say it's a bad question. I'm always happy to revisit, and I think we have good reason to revisit it since the last time we discussed it. I assume you are still mostly of the perspective that, like, even if there were a justification, you worry about the, like, functionality of that as a mode of change?
I mean, just, okay, take, for example, the violent insurrection at the Capitol. Like, did that work?
Why not? Seems like a good example.
Yeah,
to take.
Like, did that do anything for them? You know, like, here's what I you know, it's genuinely impossible, though. The question that I don't even want to ponder, because I talked about this on my other show, is, like, I don't know if everybody realizes this, if this is common knowledge, but the difference in the election was 40,000 votes. 40,000 votes! There's the difference between winning and losing because of our stupid electoral college. 40,000. Mm-hmm. It's closer than 2016. And so what if that had gone the other way? I mean, people try to make the number smaller. They're like, yeah, if 20,000 people flipped their votes. And yeah, I mean, I guess that is a way you can say it, but I don't really think many people flip their votes. I think it's more that either people don't get out to vote for Trump or don't get out to vote for Biden. You know, I think it's staying home versus going out or, you know, mailing in your ballot. But anyway, either way you want to put it, if either 20,000 votes flipped or 40,000 people just didn't vote for Biden in three states, I think it was. I can't remember now. Two states, three states, one or the other. If that had happened, what if we had President Trump winning, but Biden won by 8 million votes? I mean, what would we do? Like, should we have been at the Capitol? What would I, you know, like, our stupid idiot system that we are stuck with tells us that Trump won in that instance, even though, you know, there's all the, there's so many other things to it. I mean, it would have been It's bad enough if it's just a fair election in all other respects except the Electoral College. That's already bad. Like, that's already one level of, you know, thing we have to contend with. The other part of it is the voter suppression, the effing with the mail, you know, the killing the post office, doing all the stuff they did to try to, you know, reduce turnout. If we had fallen short, you know, by those 40,000 votes or whatever, I genuinely don't know. But the other part of it is we still would, like, if any of us got together and did something in the Capitol, we still would have just looked like these idiots at the Capitol, although we wouldn't have been that dumb. But, like, it doesn't do anything. Like, if your system decides that something is legitimate, there's not, you know, like, I don't understand how this is going to go. Does somebody have a plan for how this would have done anything? I don't know.
Yeah, so I mean, here's my feelings after the Capitol is, I think a lot of folks felt like it was very easy to score political points by being the ones who say, well, we would never do violence. We would never do a violence like this. It's very easy in that moment to be like, oh, these terrible people who've done a violence, that's so bad. And I don't think that's the right answer, because I do think there is a time somewhere out there potentially where it is just to do a violence. And what I think is, which I think connects to sort of what you're saying, is that we are in one of these really bad situations where there could be a justified reason to do a violence. You're not going to know in the moment whether you are in one of those truly justified moments. And it is a very low likelihood of success for all the reasons that you are sort of elucidating. And our current system is so badly damaged and there's no good mechanism for repair that we continue to grind towards that hypothetical line while having no better mechanisms for assessing where it is.
It's truly just like the worst.
Yep.
We're just,
it's all the bad.
Yeah. Trapped. It blows.
Slowly being pushed towards the cliff.
Yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. I agree with you that there is some, you know, line at which you'd have to resort to that. I don't know exactly where it is. I'm not sure.
Yeah, and so, like, that's also us just focusing in on our current crises. We can imagine certainly other situations in which more severely oppressed individuals would be theoretically more justified. And you could imagine sort of situations in which it would be more likely to produce functional results, such as if you're, I guess, working with certain kinds of administrations that are highly susceptible to counter-revolutionary behavior.
The first step, like if something was really going to happen, the first step would be massive, just like occupation. You know, it'd be like, it wouldn't be like jump straight to let's go assault a Capitol police officer. That doesn't even really make sense, which, you know, again, even if we had to resort to something terrible, I think I would hope that it would be in a more logical way that, you know, is constructive, as in we could block off access to places. We could, you know, we could do a bunch of stuff that's like really resistancy, but not full out trying to go hurt people. That I think there would be a lot of stops along the way to something like the Capitol, I suppose. Now, I'm just thinking through it. I don't know. I'm glad we didn't have to think about this for this particular thing.
Like, right.
I don't know.
Even that would still, I imagine, look like the militia guys hanging around buildings with their guns, not doing anything, but like being intimidating in that kind of way. And I think there's something to be said that in our current climate, and maybe this is, you know, neoliberalism controlling us and that's bad, but like in our current climate, there is such a high cost for being tagged as the one who did the violence in our system that, like, I don't see it being also a functional mechanism.
It's never going to – here's my argument for why it's never going to work. I'm kind of thinking through this on the fly, but it's not as though – Trump and Trumpism is like a small sect, and therefore that's why they failed. I mean, think about it. Every bit as outraged as we would have been had Trump won in that scenario that I already outlined, Trump's supporters already they've already got them all whipped up to the idea, you know, that the election was stolen.
Right.
And it's, again, They had, what did Trump have? 74 million votes to Biden's 82 million votes or something. It's not as though, here's what I'm saying. The Capitol thing was a failure. And it's not as though the reason it was a failure is because the ratio of the 74 million votes to the 82 million votes, you know? Mm-hmm. So like, even if we, so let's say the 82 million lost and we were as outraged, like, could we have been more outraged than the Q people? I don't know. Like, they were pretty outraged. Right. And so the idea that, like, no, but if we lost, we would have been able to put together some giant resistance better than what they tried to do. I mean, I guess that's true to an extent with the Women's March and that kind of thing and some Black Lives Matter stuff, but those weren't violent. Like, as much as conservatives and Fox News try to paint them as that, those weren't violent. And that's why I think you can get a lot more people out. But in terms of some sort of actual armed something, coup, whatever, actually getting people to do that. I mean, if Trump couldn't get the QAnon people to do that when he won 74 right. million votes and a high percentage of those 74 million think it was stolen from him, I don't know how we would do better than that. You know, like, I don't know how we would we'd get greater numbers to go do something like that.
Right. This is one of my friends' primary argument for why we shouldn't be worried about, like, full-scale civil war is that, like, Americans are just not in a position of wanting to, like, take up full-scale civil war.
It will be
other
easier
Americans,
for
like,
us in this country. It's different when you're in a war-torn, you know, awful, probably because we've bombed it or something, like, you know, country that has been left with nothing. And you don't have alternatives. You don't have a system in place. You don't have a job, you know. That if we got to that anywhere at that level here, then sure, maybe, you know, but like it's way easier even for nut job Trump people. It was way easier for them to just sit in their comfortable lives because they are very comfortable. They're better off, you know, by income. Lower income people vote Democrat. It's you know, it's in the exit polls. It's how it goes there. You know, that's the high comfortable white people go back to their comfortable white people places and just be an asshole about Trump, you know, like for that'll be easier to them than like, oh, no, for most of them, for 99 point, you know, something percent of them. Sure. Some small number of them did this Capitol riot and, you know, that they should all be punished and obviously arrested and all that. But like for the most people in this country, it's going to be far more comfortable to just go back and, you know, just be a jerk on social media about it.
Right. And most we're likely going to see probably, you know, more isolated incidents of violence against government officials or something. Yeah.
Yeah. Lone wolf kind of all stuff. Right. Yeah.
Well,
that's a depressing question. I've been like honestly avoiding that question because it's so not that particular question, but like that just that whole thing is just it was seriously when I looked at those numbers, I was like I was wrecked for a week. I was like, we came that close. That close. Mm-hmm. All right, moving on. Philosophy.
Yeah, no, the numbers have been freaking me out recently. Yeah. Was the I did the background, you know, back of my hand math on some recent polling on white evangelical QAnoners, and it was something like there's probably 14 million white evangelicals who firmly believe in QAnon. So that's not something that we're dealing with well, I think.
You know, while we're on this topic. Would you imagine, you know, people know that I've been really critical of Sam Harris and you know, I'm sure you have too as well. But like, wouldn't it be nice if we had the Sam Harris-esque approach to QAnon and Christianity in this country that he did to Islam forever? Well, if you do the math of there's certain amount of people don't think women should be allowed to something in the Muslim world, quote unquote, you know, like, okay, yeah, all right, fine. How about you focus on this country and the fact that Christian nationalists just stormed our capital and like did, you know, spend a minute to do the calculation of like, okay, we have extremists living in this country and we, you know, what, like the worldview that is, motivating them and enabling them is a Christian nationalist worldview. If you're an American, that's what you should be focusing your time on. That, you know, that's where the religious terrorism is right now in this country. It's different around
rather
the world,
than holding conferences with them.
Yeah. And being employed by them. Yeah.
Yeah. That sort of thing.
Might be a different story if you're, of course, if you're in a different part of the world, but in America, that's the religious fundamentalism and extremism and terrorism that we're dealing with. All right. Yep. Sorry.
All right. More names.
Is it your turn? Yeah, I think it's right.
It is me. Right. So thanks to Cowbell. Sometimes you pork the streak. Sometimes the streak porks you. Gunther, Jody, Corey Ebert, Winchester's Forever, Donkey Hots or something. It's got a weird symbol. John Schmidt, Mimesis Looks Like Your Mises, Sky, Michael Marenko, Raytho, Morbo the Annihilator, The Fungus Told Me We Should Start Our Own Religion with Blackjack, Hookers, and Good Epistemology. Oh, God. Mo Perry, Stop, Ask a Question, Karaoke Legend Would Ask. Nicholas, I'm sorry, I'm back on the fungus. I've totally been derailed by the fungi. Yeah. Nicholas Stark, Westerberg, Our Utopia Has Been Saved from a Monster, Rain, Colbin Erdahl, Jesse Saprell, Yesh, Medicine Bird, Skeptical Wonder, Don, and Tom Harris. Whew.
All right. Malleus Vermentum Ne Mr. Bible Pants, or is it Nay? I can never remember how you say that. Mm. I can't remember.
I got nothing.
Following up on replicative drift, do you think the phenomenon would be a quantum woo-based thing like Bob, where it's based on the instance of replication just having errors? The alternative I see is in Anne Leckie's Ancillary Justice, Hugo winning book one of the Imperial something series, in which drift is presented as each instance of the core personality having its own experiences that shifts its goals over the span of the human lifetimes and beyond. All the individuals are networked together, so it's only in times where communication is cut off that they're able to express those individual desires leading to disaster. 10 out of 10 would recommend, despite lack of boning in book one. Read book two for that sort of thing, fellow perverts. That's awesome.
Maybe we've gotten a reputation as that being a central criteria.
People
criteria.
Really are tailoring their questions to us.
Look, we voluntarily read all of the Bob books, despite there being a total lack of Bob boning in those books.
Not a bone to be found.
Yeah, nobody got Bob down once. Okay, so replicative drift. So this was actually, I wanted to mention first, we didn't get a chance in our Bob extravaganza to talk about sort of what they talk about in book four when it comes to the replicative drift, which I thought was an interesting side philosophical issue. We mentioned a little bit about, like, they started to find that there was, you could be the same entity could be transferred and uploaded without any replicative drift, and that you could create copies of yourself that didn't drift as long as you deleted the original before the new one uploaded. And they figured out that you could do this in a sort of way that was appeared to be transferring information faster than the speed of light, because they would do tests of, like, bringing copies online at great distances, and they always found that whoever was brought online first was the original, and then the other one was a drifted copy in this way.
Yeah.
And so I think what they were getting at there is it's some sort of quantum entanglement was the closest they got to a scientific Jingly Keys explanation, where it's like, but, like, a quantum entangling of what? Like, souls was the way they sort of, I think, as far as they got in that book. I don't know. Do you remember that part? Do you have any differences of interpretation?
Yeah, I think you've explained it about as well as I could possibly remember it or better. I agree with, I thought it was cool. You know, I don't think you have to solve the hard problem of consciousness to write a book, you know, because otherwise there would be no books. So I was okay with the...
I think it would benefit if somebody would get on top of that.
Yeah. I think it was cool to be like, wow, here's, invent a thing that you would observe in the world, in this world. And it's like, oh my God, this is super cool data that we have, that, like, we do these experiments and there seems to be, what was it, the principle of the nearest relative or something like that, where it's like the closest something or other, where they found that you do carry on, you know. I like it. It's like, here, we did an experiment to discover a thing. We still can't explain it because no one can explain any of this in real life or in fiction.
Right.
But it seems to be that, you know, if you double a Bob, like the first Bob to wake up or something will be the one that is the Bob. Yeah. So I agree that the initially we talked about replicative drift in like book one, you know, we talked about it as, mm-hmm. oh, you just have different experiences and they would change you, you know, despite mm-hmm. starting mm-hmm. as a perfect clone. Mm-hmm. And I think there's nothing wrong with that idea. It wouldn't explain kind of the extreme, like immediate drift that mm-hmm. we were seeing in the book, but it would have been a fine way to do it, in my opinion. Like, yeah, that makes sense. You drift because you have different experiences, whatever. But that's very much not what he did in the book, you know, like...
Right, not what it ends up being.
Yeah, it ends up being the thing you said, which is, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, it was a cool shift, because that was certainly the impression I had earlier in the book, that it was sort of like maybe even a kind of unconscious psychological individuation kind of thing, where in order to maintain your sanity, you differentiate yourself from the predecessor so that
I think you would. Mm-hmm. It makes perfect mm-hmm. sense, you know?
Right. Psychologically, I think that makes sense. But it's interesting that they added this layer of even when there's nothing, when there's no felt sense or need to differentiate, you still do it in this way because there's something prior to the experiences that is either carrying over or not.
It was very soul-y. Cool. Yeah. And mm-hmm. you know, fine, whatever. But it's kind of a cool idea. Like, it's almost like there's only one for a given Bob, you know, like there's a Bob soul for this particular iteration. And then if you copy it, that soul is already being used. So it's like you need a new one mm-hmm. or something. Like, it's mm-hmm. almost like that kind of, but quantum.
Right. Exactly. There's been lots of interesting pieces on various, like, we could imagine sort of a whole section of discussions on individuality drift within artificial entities in science fiction. So you could talk about, like, one of my favorite ones is Hugh in the Borg in Star Trek Worlds. So you have this Borg that, like, similar to what is being described here in Ancillary Justice, he has no individuality until he's separated from them. He's cut off from the collective. And what they ended up doing is minor spoilers for a 20 plus year old movie show. They give him a sense of individuality, and he takes it back to the collective and infects the collective with a sense of individuality that starts to, like, undermine the Borg in that particular part of the storylines. And they do a really great job in the Picard series circling back round to that plot line. So I like those as other versions, but I do think that this stuff always comes back to these kind of ship of Theseus for our individual self kinds of questions.
Yeah. I really wonder what the answer to that is, and transporter problems or whatever. Like, mm-hmm. if you do somehow clone yourself, like, who is you? Where is that? It's amazing. I don't know how it would work.
And I do like the idea that ultimately the chunking is to some extent arbitrary, but we could say, you know, bad cases make for bad law or whatever that to crib from your other show. Like, we shouldn't be making our personhood judgments based on weird transporter cases, like strange edge cases. We can readily give an account of personhood that functions for the 99.9% of experiences,
like,
that we
technologically have. This could eventually be a thing, you know. Like, if you could upload your consciousness, what does happen? Like, let's say you perfectly reproduce somehow everything going on in your brain in a computer. Mm-hmm. Do you wake up as the computer or the person? Does it matter that, you know? And, like, I'm sure there's ways you can tweak the experiment to where it's like, no, you moved into the computer, and then you could probably tweak your intuitions by saying, oh, wait, but the body, they woke up the body again. And then are you that brain? Like, would you felt like you woke up there? Well, you know, it's weird.
Well, yeah. Have you read the classic Dennett paper about the when Dennett, you know, gets separated from his body, and, like, his brain is in one thing and his body is another, and then there's an artificially copied version of him on the computer as well, and he switches back and forth between them?
I've read a lot of Dennett, but I don't remember that.
Oh, all right. Maybe we should do an episode on that, because that's basically literally just this whole
thing.
And then
we can pick
that would be a fun
any number of the transporter whatevers in Star Trek. Although we've done a lot of Trek, I'm sure we can move on to some other stuff.
The fun thing about that story is it is itself a short science fiction narrative.
Oh, it is.
So we could theoretically
use
it as its own piece of content if we wanted to.
Yeah. No, that's an even better idea.
It's even lazier.
All right. I have no brain these days. My turn? Your turn?
Your turn.
What number am I on?
226.
226. Victor, the thing I do is I start prepping the next one and then forget that I did that. And then I'm like, wait, do I need to go ahead another 25? Victoria V, general contact unit problem child. Wait, I'm curious. Former internet spaceship politician. Paul, Mara J, Jason Wright, Josh Brandon, Erica Pullen, Brandon Stephen Tevis or Teves or something. Join your labor union. Thank you, Biden, for revoking EO's.
Oh, God.
13, 8, 36, 7, and 9. Full
good
name.
Job. That was great.
Grant Webster, Alexis Olson, James Mudd, Jason King, Craig Caraggio, Shane Giberson, United States versus 43 and a half gross dead parrots. Support basic science research, serious, god awful, scathing citation, crat, shoeshine arguments in space. Cactrot. The Collaborators Party, yeah. Thomas corrupted me into buying a quarter pounder, and I'm so mad with cheese. That's an old one. And Brian R. Did I mention on this show that I finally got to try the vegetarian Crunchwrap? It's just black beans instead of...
You did, I think. I was think that you this show? That it was
okay.
I don't know if you mentioned it on the show or just mentioned to me after the show and I made fun of you, but I think...
I could I remember, remember I said it on OA or on this show. Anyway, yeah. Sorry. It's either way, it was good.
Pretty sure it was on this show.
Yeah, okay, sorry. Anyway, I'll mention no one on the show has
we are brains in a vat and yet we have no brains left. What are we yeah. We're just the vats at this point.
I am just a vat. That's affirmative.
Just the utility vat.
All right,
fill me up.
Octa Est, however you tell me we pronounce that. Five of my closest family members have been locked in a room. Yeah, strong start already. Here we go. I can't say for sure whether they are alive or dead, but the longer they stay in the room, the more likely it is that they will die. The only way I can even have a chance of saving them is to kill the man who holds the key. He can't open the door himself, and while he seems to be relatively pleasant every other way, I know that the only way to open the door is to kill him. Should I do it? If so, how is this different from Tuvix? If not, then how do we justify saving one to sacrifice five? Ooh. Okay. I feel like this is your problem. You're the one who's wrong about Tuvix. Or did I think I eventually
problem.
Agreed with you, huh?
You did. So we're both wrong about Tuvix. I think I have a really hard time with it's okay for you to murder a basically pleasant bureaucrat for the sake of freeing five loved ones. I like, I don't know.
You can ask the guy to open the door very nicely.
Right. Right. But like, yeah, I guess you could say, I'm trying to think if there's any ways in which I could hang sort of a deontological distinction about meaningful differences here, but like ultimately no, I don't think there is a super meaningful difference here. I think Tuvix is a physically embodied trolley problem, and you know, she provides
run his
one
ass
trolley
over.
Solution. Yeah. Yeah, she pulls that lever. That's her choice.
To make this thought experiment accurate, you need to be like, okay, it's two people locked in a room and one of them you really freaking hate. Like it's one of them is everybody in the whole building hates this person. Mm-hmm, the other person, I don't know, seems fine. I don't have an opinion on.
pretty standard.
And then the guy at the door, the doorman, is universally loved by all. Right. So do you kill the door, universally loved by all doorman, to save? You know, it's like Tom Hanks. A young Tom Hanks is the doorman.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And inside... is, how do we keep this going? The actor who plays Neelix.
Who is also on Avenue 5 now.
Wait, that HBO show?
Yep.
Oh, did that go, you say now, did that go another, I thought it was one season, right? Or
I assume it's probably going to come back post-pandemic. I think it did
okay,
well
I
enough.
I just wasn't sure if it like
probably...
it had enough, based on, sorry, I'm adjusting my mic. Based on how you said that, I've made it sound like, oh, he just popped up in a new thing. But okay.
No,
reason.
No. Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah.
Was he as obnoxious?
Pretty much. No, it's hard to be as obnoxious as Neelix. Like that's a tall order. But he's creepy. He's creepy like Neelix. So
I would rather have
over.
Creepy than Neelix. Okay. Same. Anyway. Mm-hmm, anyway, mm-hmm. that's the experiment. I agree.
I feel
ethically you'd be like you and Tuvix would be like, look, ethically, I know I'm supposed to kill you right now, but like, let's say you lost the key. We don't need to save that person locked in there.
If my soon-to-be new puppy was in the room, I'd probably kill the guard. I'll be honest about that.
Yeah.
But, I bet. Like, five closest family.
One
of the five is the puppy.
Why aren't there more trolley problems exposing the pure idiocy of all of humans and their pets? Humans would kill every other human for their dog.
Oh, yeah. That's why whenever I make my moral realism arguments, I cite torturing puppies. It's just, you do what works. But I think you made a good point here that if you really wanted to make this argument, if you wanted to make this thought experiment comparable to Tuvix, having the five of your closest family members, like it's a 2-to-1 scenario in the original, and you've taken
from
a 2-to-1 to a 5-to-1, and like either it matters or it doesn't. And if it doesn't, you should keep them the same. And if it does, you should really keep them the same.
Agreed.
Yes. So, I'm just being needlessly cruel now.
But look,
I
that was one of the rare, they say not a lot of progress is made in philosophy. That was one of the rare instances where I think I solved it with my waiver system. The paperwork you sign going into the transporter, you sign that paperwork. Mm-hmm. The minute something might be wrong, bam, stasis for everybody. I
just
solved
like
it.
A woke person.
Why are we still talking about this? I solved it.
It's just like a woke neoliberal bureaucrat to think that you can solve these problems with consent forms.
Your whole thing was that once Tuvix has been alive and everybody, he's gone on several dates with everybody in the crew for some reason.
We have so many more things to read, by the way. All right,
let's do
this.
I feel like particular quandary I saw.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. I'll give it to you. I'll put it in your column.
Thank you.
I'll put it up on the board. All right. Thanks to Jess Benning, The Testimony of Mushroom, Cleopatra Smith, Brianna Wilson, Odin the Law Dog, Jake, Utuk Zool, Christian Rose, Charlie Foxtrot, Mr. E, almost went there, Werweasel, Camille Essicat, Charlotte Hughes, I know, that's exactly where I went, Mark Kritzman, I Am a Hollerback Girl, woo, Jude Law's Canadian Accent and Existens Makes My Pee Throb, Lost Dune for the Fourth Lost Dune fourth.
No one's
episode.
Canadian accent has ever made anyone's pee throb. I'm just saying, ever in the history
you
of humans.
Watched Existens that though, so you really can't claim that.
I can. There are some things that I can be sure of. It is not the Canadian accent that does it.
www.saltprairie.photography, Stephen Luttrell, Fix the Vote, Andrew Slowly Explaining Political Philosophy Is My Kink, Tua Tagovailoa, I'm not going back for it, Paul Morgan, Ryan Frias, and Lee Hornbuckle.
All right. General Contact Unit Problem Child asks, you know how after the last midterm, some people were saying the Dems taking back the House was good because it means if anything happens to Trump and Pence, Nancy Pelosi would become president. Well, I disagreed with that, but whatever. There was a similar situation in the 80s. If Reagan and Bush were both killed, Democratic Speaker Tip O'Neill would have become president. Tip O'Neill entered politics in the New Deal era and was a strong supporter of stuff like universal health care and guaranteed jobs program. In the 80s, that kind of politics was genuinely unpopular. The U.S. had been duped into believing trickle-down and the GOP were actually capable of winning popular elections. Suppose Reagan and Bush were both killed and Tip O'Neill had taken over. Would it have been right for him to try to govern as a progressive president when he'd have no Democratic mandate to do so? We all think progressive policies are good, but would you want an unelected president trying to implement them in a time when most people don't even want them? I mean, this is quite the hypothetical. I think it's... Okay, I'll go with you. I think that there's a lot more to governing than like, here's, we're going to do a universal... Well, for one thing, universal healthcare probably would have been doable. Universal healthcare didn't become unpopular until, Hillary tried to talk about it in the 90s and Republicans were already in the Rush Limbaugh, as Fox News was coming into existence, just absolutely bash everything a Democrat wants at all times. So you might have been able to pull off healthcare. I think it would have mattered how you talked about it. I can't remember. How does it work constitutionally? Is that just permanent, or do they get a chance to, like, the reason I didn't care about the Pelosi with Trump and Pence, like, I just didn't, you know, like, the odds that you would have something happen to both of them, the way they protect the president, vice president mm-hmm. these days, like, this is not happening, mm-hmm. you know, like, mm-hmm. you, and if something happened to one of them, they have time to replace that one before, mm-hmm. you know, you go down the chain of whatever. So I was, right. that was never anything I thought was anything. But yeah, I guess this, if we go with a hypothetical, I would say there's a lot you could do. Let's say, okay, I'll accept all that. You get a progressive Tip O'Neill in there and everybody's mad about it probably because they're like this, nobody elected this person, blah, blah, blah. I think mm-hmm. A, it would matter like when it was and when the election was. And I'm not just trying to get out of the question. Like it would really matter. Like, let's say we could maybe adjust our dials. Are we saying it's like 1980 or are we saying it's like 1985? You know, like where you get like a full term before they're presumably going to be kicked out because, if you know, assuming that the whole country, if it's like, you know, 1984 and a half or something, and mm-hmm. it, you know, that could be a whole different story. But let's assume you get some time to do some stuff. I think there's a lot you could do to rhetorically sound like you're doing one thing, but then just do the other. Like, honestly, that's how right. I feel about a lot of politics now. It's such a stupid, irrational game, and it's mm-hmm. all about. And I said this on my show the other day, we need to in some ways govern how Trump did in certain ways. Like if we do something like get checks out or cancel student loan debt, we need to throw ourselves a parade and just pat ourselves on the back. It's it's so dumb. It's the opposite of what Obama was. Everything about Obama was don't spike the football, don't sell, you know, and he's an amazing, dignified person for another time. Like we're past that time now. Like what you uh-huh. have to actually do is put your stupid name on the checks that people get. It's like, honestly, you do.
Right.
Because otherwise people don't think you did anything for them. They're not going to, out of the goodness of their heart, if they're having a good year, think, I bet it was the Democrats who made this happen. No, you have to actually put your name on everything that you give them and like run on it and stuff. And so I feel like there's a lot you could do to like rhetorically, if you were in this weird hypothetical, rhetorically say like, well, I recognize the will of the people is such and such, and I'm going to carry on the legacy of the Babadoo. And then just do as much as you can low key, you know, to like, for one thing, executive power and all that, like there is so much good that would have been done to have a Tip O'Neill rather than Reagan, like response to AIDS, you know, like there's a ton of stuff that like, I don't think would have, you know, garnered much opposition. Mm-hmm. You would have had to be able to pay keen attention and know what was going on and blah, blah, blah. You know, like it was more like the fact that attention wasn't being paid to that stuff that Reagan was able to just totally screw the gay community over, for example, on AIDS and that kind of thing. So there, mm-hmm. I think there's tons you could do, tons of good you could have done that would have flown under the radar. And then maybe you try to like find a way of balancing the good and the bad, you know, like if you're trying to stay in power, because it would be better if you could get reelected or something, for example, like you would be able to do more good. You know, maybe you try to like hand them some victories while also trying to move the needle on where the country is by using rhetorical skill, they, you know, stuff like that. That's how I would look at it. But the thing is, like, if you're talking about passing universal health care, I mean, you still have to go through Congress. Being president doesn't. In fact, mm-hmm. it's the opposite of that. Congress has to pass something for you and you sign it. So it's not as though you could just, because you're president, you make that happen. Like, presumably right. in the scenario, you still have a staunch, I mean, the House, how did this work? The House was Democrat forever, wasn't it? Like, from the 50s to the 90s or something like that? Or was mm-hmm. it the Senate? No, was it the Senate? No. Shit, I always mix it up. One of them was held by Democrats for like a billion years. And I think it was
I'm pretty sure it was the House, because I think Gingrich is the one who smashes
yeah.
it.
That's what I'm thinking too. But anyway, regardless, it would depend on Congress and it would all depend on what you could get them to do. So anyway, that's my thought. You got any thoughts on that hypothetical?
I think so as to the moral question of whether you should or shouldn't govern based on this kind of idea of a democratic mandate, I don't put a lot of stock in the concept at this point personally, to be honest. I think that generally speaking, people who govern should be doing what seems to them to be the best for the sake of the country, and ideally be worrying less rather than our current amount of sort of very carefully tailoring their behavior to what is perceived to be the democratic mandate, because I think what is perceived to be the democratic mandate is heavily manipulated in such a way that tends to lead towards less progressive agendas, broadly speaking. So, like, I think you're spot on in the sense that, and this is what I think sort of like Biden is kind of doing right now, where he's basically just like, I'm doing moderate things and then doing progressive things. And I think, like, generally my feeling has been conservatives have always been like, we're doing moderate things and they're doing far right things. And like, Democrats have countered with, you know, we're doing moderate things and then trying to do moderate things that end up getting pulled right because the right only wants to do
right. I would amend that to say Republicans have been, we're doing far right things and then doing further right things, actually. But
sure. Sometimes in the past they did cater to the more moderate area, but I agree they have been less interested with that kind of thing at this point. So, like, yeah, I especially, you know, imagine the scenario that we're talking about. You just had a huge epic societal crisis of some sort, like some sort of massive natural disaster or a really well-organized attack on our government has just taken place. Yeah. In either case, like, worrying about what voters thought 8 months to 3 years ago makes no sense. You should be doing what is right in that particular moment, given that rapidly evolving situation.
Yeah, agreed. We got one more to squeeze in, even though we're late. I think we can do it.
All right.
And lots of names.
Yeah. You want me to finish off these names? Shall I?
I can do the last set if you want, or you do it. Either way.
Right, here we go. I'm doing it. Thanks to Ryan Harper, Gabe O'Brien, Calvin, Kate Stone, Beard of Bees, Jason Mobley, Dapper Dawkins, Daddy Deals, Deconverters Dosh, Yeet the Rich, Mean Blackbird, Sean Michael, Just John, Sean Michael together is funny to me, Kevin Durnham, Siblian, Forrest Fisher, Stephen Adams, Babblefish, Osmium, Corey Gillespie, I am an independent male spider who don't need no D's. Chris G, Drawlethanul, Bob in Utah, Aiden Metcalf, Rambo Billy, Gabby, Roslyn Walker, Joel, Fred Stokes, Perspective Penguin, Adra Panza, Employed Again, So Increasing Pledges, Flaming Wall of Death, Anna, Igor Strove, Nothing Does Not Exist in This Universe, Rich McGee, Help Andrew Stole the Earth Seed to Battle Thomas, You and the Bomb, You the Bomb, and You Got a Dope Soul and Hella Ethics. Zed is Nothing, and Rochelle Solar. Got there.
You did it, buddy. But we never got our DVD menu thing. Too bad.
We didn't. We missed it on
the
this
Testimony
one.
Of Mushroom asks, you are in a room without, here we go, another room. It's rooms all the way down. With an artifact that upon being touched for the first time will imbue you with extraordinary powers. You may become like Harry Seldon. Who's that? Or the mule from the Asimov Foundation.
The mule is. Yeah,
don't know who that is. The God Emperor of Dune. I mean, I can guess. Or High Consul of, this is a you question, I think. High Consul of Laconia from The Expanse, an attempt to make the galaxy better via imprinting your will upon it. You may instead ascend like an entity on Star Trek, all your current values no longer seeming important, and to do nothing to assist humanity. You may land somewhere in between like Professor Xavier. This is a lot of possibilities. Xavier, Dr. Manhattan, who have the power to impose their will on the rest of civilization but choose not to. Do you know what will happen to you if you touch the artifact? Do you touch it? If you are hesitant to touch it, would your decision change if everyone else was waiting outside the room waiting for the same choice? It will only work once. This is a push. Okay, well, I'm going to go work on a flow chart to try to...
Let me draw you a map here. Let me explain some things. No, not enough time. I'll sum up here. Harry Sheldon... Seldon, is a character from the Asimov series as well as the Mule. We haven't done Asimov's Foundation trilogy yet, but it's a fairly interesting, large series. So, right. So the question here, as I understand it, is do I take a chance on becoming an extraordinarily powerful entity with some range of weirdnesses, varying from being turned into a giant space worm or just being Dr. Manhattan? Would I or would I not? I think yes. Like, I don't know how I would resist something that interesting. That just seems like could just be too exciting an activity to pass up on, I guess. What do you think?
I latched on to a different part of the question that I actually think is interesting. Okay. Let's say I'm going to, you know, as Princess Bride, too long. Let me sum up or whatever. let's say it's just giving you some extraordinary power. But I like the part that's like, do you accept this extraordinary power? Or if you don't do it, it's going to a random member of our planet, like a random other person on the planet. Do you? That actually strikes me as kind of a tough choice, because like my first instinct would be, I don't deal with this. Like, find somebody, the aforementioned Obama, give him all the power. I trust him, or somebody, you know, somebody better than me with, you know, I don't trust me, and I don't want the hassle. But then what if you said like it's going to go to a random person? You got to, oh man, you know, like, do I risk that it goes to like a Trumper? Do I risk, you know, like, holy crap. I don't think you could risk that. I think you would have to do it. That'd be an interesting, they should put that into something, and maybe it isn't something, but like, that'd be interesting to be like, well, I don't want to do this, but I guess I have to. It's going to go to a random person. That could be terrible.
Yeah, you could argue that it's even worse than totally random, because if you think about the kind of person who would be willing to say yes to that artifact, right? You're leaning towards narcissistic personalities potentially, and so you might argue that like you have a strong moral obligation as an individual who knows that you're unlikely, hopefully, right, to use that, less likely, I should say. Like, who knows what happens when you get turned into a giant space worm, but like, hopefully.
I do. Don't want to know.
It's messy, let's be honest. You need people just to sort of mop the floors as you move around. But yeah, when you know, you probably would argue better you than any other person who would quickly jump at the chance to do so. And so it's another version of that, like, you know, Cincinnatus idea of you want the person who rules to be the person who least desires to rule in that kind of way.
Yeah, that'd be a tough conundrum. That'd be a quandary. I mean, I think you'd have to do it. It would be a cool thing for a show or something or a book that probably already exists. Just like truly capturing the feeling of like, I don't want to do this. Like, I would way rather not have to mess with this, but like, I cannot risk this happening. So you have to do it. That'd be really interesting. I mean, you get that in some of the superhero stuff, you know, like.
Yeah, there's a little bit of that in the Watchmen HBO show, sort of, with Manhattan's powers.
Yeah. Well, that was a lot of fun. That's our listener cues 20. And, we can give a preview for next week.
Yes, we can. And it's fullness time. We have waited, waiting is, and now fullness has been reached and the cusp has arrived. And we are doing Stranger in a Strange Land. I'm so excited. I am unapologetically excited, and nothing you say will change that.
Cool. I'm not planning on saying anything anyway, so.
Are you just going to sit there and let me
drone on
in Martian for an hour?
Yeah. We'll just put it
just
on.
Croaking
put me
noises.
On mute and pretend I was there for all that.
Oh, buddy. It's not going to be like Dune. It's going to be better. It's going to be better than Anthem, man. Come on. You read this one.
Yeah, Dune would have been a little more fun. I don't get it, man. Maybe you can explain to me why this is good. I don't. Anyway, that'll be fun.
I'm gonna explain it to you, and you're gonna be converted, and it's
you
gonna
can
be we're gonna grok and
Martian
grow closer.
Yeah, I do grok you. Okay, let's. And then we don't need to thank our patrons because we just thanked everybody. So I guess the only thing to say is we're gonna go after dark. I see some after dark questions that we're gonna tackle. Should be a lot of fun. Hop on the Patreon and listen to the bonus extended episode every week. And get the episodes early, by the way. Like, what is it, a week or two early? It's a lot early.
2 weeks. Mm-hmm.
2 weeks early. Well, I will say this to patrons. Aaron is going to be on my Twitch channel for Portal 2 this Friday, as you're hearing this. For everybody else, you were too late. Yeah, what can I say? Hopefully you found the information some other way. But we're going to play Portal 2 and talk philosophy and all that. Friday at what did we say 4 p.m. Pacific, I think.
Yeah, I'm going to try to turn you into a ship of Theseus.
All right. We'll see everybody then. Anyway, time for After Dark. Bye, everybody.
This has been a burst transmission of Philosophers in Space. All music written and performed by Thomas Smith. If you've enjoyed your infotainment upload, please locate the nearest podcast interface device and fill it with 5-star ratings and glowing reviews. If you think Ground Control should spring for fun new goodies and content, consider supporting us at patreon.com/zeroG. You can find us on Twitter at zeroG Philosophy, where Aaron will instantly and compulsively respond. Or you can email us at philosophersinspace@gmail.com. Finally, if you're sad that it takes so long for our signals to reach Earth, you can always find Thomas over at Serious Inquiries Only and Opening Arguments, and Aaron over at Embrace the Void. Until next time, live long and philosopher.